Medienhölle.
Dokument.
Herzlich willkommen zur zweiten grünen Ausgabe der Medienhölle. Grün steht für Dokument. In dieser grünen Reihe stelle ich Ihnen gelegentlich, wenn uns die Veranstalter zum Beispiel die Rebroadcasting-Genehmigung erteilen, Dokumente vor, die Sie eins zu eins so betrachten können, als wären Sie selbst dabei gewesen. So zum Beispiel bei der Verleihung der RIAS Awards 2026 am 7. Mai 2026 im Berliner Rathaus 18 Uhr. Wir haben die freundliche Genehmigung der RIAS Commission, hier die Preisverleihung zu dokumentieren und auch die Diskussionsrunde, die Klaus Kleber leitet. Durch das Programm führt Melissa Körner und Angela von Brakel.
And now to the heart of the program, honoring outstanding transatlantic journalism. The RIAS Media Awards, dun dun dun, 5 categories, 1 new highlight. Our winners will take home a brand new trophy. A bear. Our American friends might say, a bear, oh, that's cute. Oh, no, it's a big deal. And let's just say you don't just get a bear. I mean, it takes some serious paperwork and a lot of convincing. So, Chris, thanks for making that happen. Let's get started. Here's our first category, the TV award.
If you sleep in a democracy, you wake up in a dictatorship. That's how one of the person describes what's at stake. And it raises a question. What happens if a political movement moves from the margins closer to power? And this film takes us inside that shift in Germany. Let's take a look.
Support for the alternative for Germany is higher than ever before.
Correspondent Evan Williams investigates the surging popularity of Germany's new right.
Now we are the party of the future.
The influence of Russia.
The Russians have conducted disinformation and warfare.
And the United States.
The far right and the Euroskeptics in Europe feel that they've now got their man in the White House.
Donald Trump.
They're no longer excluded, but actually they're part of the political process now.
Suspense. The TV award goes to Hannah Congdon, Vanessa Schlesi, and Evan Williams for the well-researched and richly layered documentary The Rise of Germany's Right Wing, which aired on the Frontline program on PBS in the United States. Congrats.
Big one.
Congrats.
So, of course, we want to know a little bit more about your work. And Vanessa, you follow people who actively shape political narratives. And while watching that film, we were wondering, did you ever have the feeling that they were trying to shape your story?
Well, I mean, I guess in a way, a lot of everyone that we talk to wants to show and report and tell their own narrative. But that's journalism. It's a craft, you know. We know what we're doing. There are rules. And PBS Frontline is very, very strict to adhere to these rules. And that is exactly the thing that differentiates us from, in the times of, you know, that we live in, fake news, from YouTubers and influencers. That come up right and left at this moment. So this is why, even if that would have happened, we know our craft.
Oh, Chris, you.
And Evan, there's a line in your documentary: "We win because the others fail." Do you think that mindset defines politics today?
I think it does. I think what we're seeing across, not just in Germany, but across the major economies of Europe, including Britain and France and other countries, is that people are slightly fed up with the middle ground, with the traditional parties. We're seeing it everywhere. They're feeling like the cost of living is letting them down, the insecurity, etc. So people are willing to listen to more extreme complaints, not solutions, and possibly give that a try. And I think people, when you see the continuing weak coalitions that occur across the countries, people are looking for something else. So I think there is something going on that we should at least watch very closely. And can I also just say a big thanks to the jury for the award? And to Riaz for this really fantastic recognition for the work. All of us, it means a great deal to us on the team. And it also means, hopefully, well, it does mean a great deal to the commissioning editors at Frontline in Boston. And hopefully it means they may commission more films from us. Speaking to our room full of journalists, you know what I mean. It helps us a great deal. It really means a great deal to all of us. So thank you very much.
Big round of applause.
Just wait for a photo option.
So Jan is happy. Thanks so much. And now, y'all, we travel to Texas. And everyone who knows me just a tiny bit knows how much I love the Lone Star State. And since I went there when I was little, or let's just say more little than I am right now, I thought I knew all about it, right? But this radio feature provides new insights on German-American history. You'll learn a great deal about politics, about culture, directly from Germans in Texas. Let's take a look at the tease.
Oben die Männer mit Hoffmann von Fallersleben stoßet an, unten im großen Saal die Frauen mit Mussi Denn. Altes Fachwerk, Würste, Rouladen, Bier, Bach und Jodelfunk? Ist das wirklich alles, was einem zum 250. Geburtstag der USA zur deutschen Einwanderung in Texas begegnet? Echt jetzt? Nein. Aber es gehört dazu. Ich aber will jetzt noch mehr Deutsche treffen, die sich nach 1989 oder später für Texas entschieden haben.
Manchmal denke ich, dass die Leute, die aus dem Osten kommen, immer noch dieses Freiheitsgefühl suchen. Das heißt, wenn ich hier mich in Houston umschaue, dann kommt es mir so vor, als ob ich überproportional viele Leute mit ostdeutschem Hintergrund treffe.
Aber Sebastian hadert gerade mit seiner neuen Heimat und hat sich die Midterms, die amerikanischen Parlamentswahlen, als Deadline gesetzt. Wenn diese Wahlen manipuliert werden oder vielleicht gar nicht stattfinden, dann packt er, der schon einmal einen autoritären Staat verlassen hat, der die große Freiheit in den USA gesucht und gefunden hat, vielleicht wieder seine Sachen und geht.
The Radio Award this year goes to Eberhard Schade for his future Deutsch in Texas, Bachbier, Business as usual on Deutschlandfunk Kultur. With a personal and intimate perspective on his protagonist, he shows how deeply German and American histories and present realities are connected.
Oh, wait. I got this. There you go. And by the way, Eberhard is the first one ever who has both trophies. Now, the old one, and the new one, because you already won the award. Wait, I got this 2019, and it was the Fellow Award. So, double congrats. So, obviously, my first question is going to be, why Texas?
Okay. First of all, it's a golden rule with Riaz that if you go on a research, you should travel somewhere where you haven't been before. And I was never in Texas, so leave your comfort zone. I think this is Eric's philosophy. Leave your comfort zone, go out somewhere where you haven't been.
Did you go country dancing?
Did I do what?
Country dancing. A bit of two-step.
No, I did many strange things, but I will tell you later. second, I had this little personal string because my father-in-law once was a director of the Goethe Institute at the end of the 70s and beginning of the 80s. And while I was doing my research for this report, I was coming across the reopening ceremony of the Goethe Institute in Houston. So I thought, oh, that would be nice to have this in the story. And it worked.
Great job.
And but most of all, I was interested because doing my research for this report, I was coming across numbers of especially people from East Germany who went after the fall of the wall to Texas. And I was thinking, wow, immigrating to the U.S. is one thing. Immigrating to Texas, another thing. And I was thinking, so how do they feel today? I mean, seeing democracy, freedom of speech at stake, how do they feel today? That was the question that actually led me.
I can imagine, and I'm sure Melissa also has a question.
Many of your protagonists once left Eastern Germany, and they were looking for freedom. Did you ever have the feeling that they're questioning their decision right now?
Well, as the jury put it, my picture, after having talked to so many people, was durchwachsen. It was like, I met this guy who it really meant a lot to him to have the right to bear arms, to have a weapon. He showed me his weapon collection. I was like, oh, wow. And I also met people for whom Washington, D.C. was very far away. I think they put politics a little bit out of their sight. But then I met Sebastian, the guy you just said, with his family. He's the main character in my story. And he's scared. He's scared of what's going on right now. And well, he said, if it's going to get worse, I might pack my thing. And that means a whole family packing their things, coming back to Germany.
Oh, wow. All right. Thank you so much for your work. We really appreciate it.
Let me just do a little thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
Because a good story is not a good story without a team. And my team is here tonight. So this is... I don't know if Tim showed up, but Ralf is here, Katrin is here, Frank is here. I'm looking in their eyes so they know. thank you for your work. And then I'd like to thank my family. My beautiful wife is here, Tina, and my son and my daughter, Stella and Hannah and Moritz are here tonight. Thank you for your love and inspiration. And I'd like to thank two colleagues in Texas who really helped me a lot finding my people for my story. This is Andrew and Florian. And
we got time, just go
last
ahead,
but
you know?
Not least, I want to thank a very dear old friend of mine, mm-hmm. because I have to tell this little story.
I'm just finished. Ahead. Okay. Yeah.
He's sitting right there. It's my friend, dear old friend Achim.
Hi.
Because like 10 or 12 years ago, he visited me in this beautiful Rias building. I have the pleasure to work every day. And he went... because he was part of the RIAS program in 2002, he told me today. And he said, I'm going to stop by at Rainer Haaster's office. Why don't you come? So I went, and this is the beginning of this beautiful relationship. I went on this trip. I went to prices. Thank you. Thank you all.
Full circle moment.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Ciao. All right, next up, the Digital Award, and I'll give you this much. We all know binge watching, right? This was my first binge listening to a podcast. Is that a thing? I think I should trademark it. Yeah, there you go. What do you think?
I did binge listen it too, but I had to process it a couple of times because this story isn't just about a tech billionaire. It's a story about power and who really holds it. Or to put it in different words, who is the most powerful player in a game of chess?
Das ist Peter Thiel, ein Milliardär, ein superreicher Investor und Ideologe. Einer, der gerne im Hintergrund bleibt.
Peter Thiel ist hochintelligent, kein Zweifel.
Der denkt nicht global, der denkt universell.
Er träumt vom ewigen Leben, Er hasst Steuern und alles, was Vogue ist.
I am proud to be gay. I am proud to be a Republican. But most of all, I am proud to be an American.
Peter Thiel hat als erster im Silicon Valley Donald Trump unterstützt. Er ist der Strippenzieher hinter dem kulturellen Rechtsruck in den USA. Am liebsten hätte er seinen eigenen Staat. Und meistens bekommt er, was er will.
Peter Thiel wins, no matter what.
Die Peter Thiel Story in der Deutschlandfunk-App.
Good evening.
The Digital Award goes to Deutschlandfunk for the podcast.
Das ist Peter Thiel.
The Peter Thiel Story.
Ein superreicher.
Okay. Einer.
Herzlichen Glückwunsch, herzlichen Glückwunsch.
Congrats. You may just go here in the center. Perfect.
So of course, we have an obvious question. Why Peter Thiel? What made you think that you can find out secret things that not even many Americans knew of back in the day?
Well, that's what every commissioning editor in Germany asked us, with the exception of Deutschlandfunk. We pitched this to everybody else before, and everybody was like, Peter Thiel, is he really that important? And we are like, that's kind of part of the story, isn't it? You know, there are people who are not in the spotlight all the time and who are still really important and who are wielding power in a way. And then we told this story to Wolfgang Schiller, and he said, yeah, of course, we're doing this podcast, and that's...
Perfect.
Thank you.
The story is mainly, obviously, about Peter Thiel, but it's also about J.D. Vance, who might run for president.
Yeah, I think you can answer a question on J.D. Vance.
All right.
J.D. Vance was kind of my beat. In J.D. Vance's career, Peter Thiel is everywhere. He started it. I mean, J.D. Vance says that he would never have gone into politics without Thiel, that Peter Thiel's speech at his university was his inspiration to go into politics, and also Peter Thiel gave him $1 million for his first Senate run, and then introduced him to Donald Trump. And so, I think the thing that I find most interesting about J.D. Vance right now, apart from the fact that he's obviously at least partly Peter Thiel's creature, that I'm not exactly sure about his motives in terms of the future of democracy, and that should scare us all a little bit, I think.
It might, yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you both for being here tonight.
Thank you. Big round of applause. Thank you. I'll take that. Thank you. Oh, sorry.
And this is the next award, the Fellow Award. We're honoring the ones who did something in the transatlantic journalism.
Yeah, that podcast delivers a portrait of Germany's right-wing populist party, the AfD, and draws compelling parallels between the AfD and the MAGA movement in the United States. Let's take a look at the trailer. Maybe. That's the tease before the trailer. Pablo, yeah, no? Not yet. Here we go.
Pablo got this.
We lost democracy once. We cannot be unserious about anything that could only come close to some of this could happen again.
German democracy is built to make sure that a party like the Nazis can never come to power again. And a lot of people right now are saying it's time to ban the AfD.
They mean remigration in the sense of also pushing citizens to leave the country. That is unconstitutional.
Refugees are welcome here!
think there's just fear about like what happens if we try banning them and it isn't successful.
Ich halte von einem Parteienverbot in der Demokratie überhaupt nichts.
If the party gets banned, democracy in Germany has finished.
Today, an argument that is dividing Germany. Whether to take the drastic measure to ban their far-right party.
We lost democracy once. We cannot be unseen.
The fellow award goes to Ariel Plotnick and Emma Tarkov of the Washington Post for their report Should Germany Ban Its Far Right? For powerful reporting that combines historical context with on-the-ground voices. Please welcome Emma. We're happy you're here tonight.
So to many Americans, banning a party, as is possible in Germany, can sound undemocratic. So did your reporting change your perspective on that?
Yeah, I would say through reporting on this, I got a lot of perspective on that question. I think there are a lot of things built into German democracy, like the possibility of banning parties or the far-reaching power of the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution, that are surprising to Americans. In talking to friends and colleagues about this story, I sensed some envy, perhaps, that these mechanisms are built in at a time when, like in the US, so many of our checks and balances are under attack or are failing. So it was a real like learning experience for me, I think, to shift my thinking about how democracy is defined and defended here. I will say, like, I encountered a lot of nuance in reporting on this. I spoke to some people, like protesters at AfD events, who said that they feel that they look to America now as an example of what has happened when attacks on democracy have gone completely unchecked, which I think was kind of sobering for me to hear. And yet I spoke to many other people who oppose the AfD, but feel that banning it and depriving many voters of the party that they wish to vote for is undemocratic. So I think it's a very nuanced question. And, you know, this arises obviously out of the time that Germany's constitution was written and what it was protecting against.
Thank you so much.
And some people in your story said a ban wouldn't solve the problem. So did you come closer to an answer?
I don't think I, unfortunately, came close to answering that. I will say, you know, obviously, I encountered a lot of people who felt that even if the party is banned, the ideas that they espouse, of course, won't go away. And they feared that people would coalesce around a new party and perhaps even feel emboldened by this kind of reinforced sense of victimhood. But that said, I think, you know, a lot of people pointed out to me that a ban would have real practical and logistical effects on the AfD, you know, cutting them off from significant sources of funding or allowing them to have offices and to kind of publicly organize. And it seemed like some of those options are available even in the case of a partial ban. So I think it's not quite so much of an all or nothing black and white question as it first appeared. And I'll also say it was interesting for me to explore more about how in a multi-party system, like in Germany, there are so many options for sort of ringing off extremist ideas like the firewall that, you know, we don't really have access to in the US.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate your work. And the picture, Jan, is coming. Oh, here we go. He already is here. And your podcast, too, is very much a team effort. Unfortunately, your colleague Ariel Plotnick can't be here today, but she really has the best excuse because she's taking care of the next Rias generation. She's expecting and we are delighted for her. She did send us a video message. Let's all have a look.
Hi, everyone. This is Ariel Plotnick. I'm so sorry I can't be there, but thank you so much for this wonderful Rias Alumni Award. From the moment that Emma pitched this story, I knew it would be a fascinating topic. And that is thanks to everything I learned on the Rias program, Germany's fascinating history, politics, cultural landscape. I'm so glad that our story resonated with the judges, and I hope it continues to be a great example of how Rias can inspire journalists to make internationally rigorous work.
Thank you so much. Big round of applause. Thank you. Last but not least, the grand prize. And a little warning, because this film pulled you in and doesn't let you go. You root with the protagonists. Your pulse starts to rise. It plays like a thriller. And the entire time, one question remains. What would you do?
Yeah, and honestly, I don't know if I could have done what they did in The Talented Mr. F, because like it's a literally tricky question, and I don't want to lose too many words, because the answer is not what you would expect. Let's have a look.
Congratulations for being selected. How did that feel for you?
For people to be able to watch my film and what I've created. It's amazing.
Won Best Animated Film.
Described as a cinematic masterpiece.
One day you might get awards at the Oscars.
I'm Samuel Fallinson. I'm the director and animator for T-130. The one with the little robot in it.
Ja, unser Film wurde geklaut von einem Amerikaner. Er hat die Credits abgeschnitten, seine eigenen Credits hingepackt und den auf Festivals eingereicht.
Ja, verrückt. Wirklich verrückt.
Er hat einen YouTube-Kanal, zu der Fashion Brand gehört, einen Foley-Artist-Kanal, einen E-Sports-Kanal.
I would contact the person who did this and say, what's going on here?
Ask me, Andrew Misati, meet you. Well,
you're the original creators of the T-130.
Yeah, it did feel good. Everyone has a dark side, but they gave me an opportunity to explain myself. There's a bigger picture. How deep do I want to go with this story?
Grand Prize Award goes to the team of authors Igor Plischke, Christopher Zwickler, Annika Melin, and Hannes Besler for the ARD-MDR co-production The Talented Mr. F.
Congrats.
Congrats to you too.
So, of course we would love to do like a 10-minute interview, but we're running out of time. So how did the journey begin, and what was the most emotional moments while like doing this course of the project?
Yeah, before I answer the question, I also wanted to say a little thank you on the one hand to RIAA's commission. Thank you so much for this amazing award. It means a lot to us. But I also wanted to say thank you to the team, because we're just two on stage, but there's a big team who made this film possible. It starts with Julius Motz and Nikita, who were the seed of this production and also the driving force, not only in front of the camera, but also behind. It goes further with the director, Igor Plischke, who had a strong will to understand this complex character of Samuel and had the skill to open him up, which you will see in the master interview in the end of the film. We have a couple of other people from the team here tonight. Solmas, our producer, there's Benedict, our DOP, there's Danilo, our sound guy, the Flimmer team, but also Sarah, our editor, who can't be here tonight, and coming back to stage. Annika represents the whole team of ARD stations. This includes MDR, ARD Kultur, RBB, HR, but also, BR, sorry, Bayerischer Rundfunk. Oh. Thank you very much to all of you. Many of you are here tonight as well. It was a great sign to give us the opportunity to do the film. Coming back to your question,
you remember that? Great.
It's obviously a very emotional journey throughout the whole production. It was starting with the moment where Julius and Moritz found out that their film got stolen. And obviously they were full of rage and didn't know what to do, leading over to the journey, which was really thrilling, because there was always the risk of being exposed when we went to the United States to approach Samuel. Then obviously the big situation with the reveal, where we didn't know how he would react when he was exposed, until the release of the film in Germany, including such renowned awards that we won here tonight, for example, but also Moritz, Nikita and Julius, who won a Grimmel Prize 2 weeks ago. So we are very thankful, but obviously this is a big emotional journey.
Talking about emotional, what did the story, the experience teach you?
I think this film is very much about conflict solution, because when something is stolen from you that is precious, maybe a thing or in this case a movie, most people would react with anger or with aggressiveness or even try to get revenge. But our protagonists, Moritz, Julius and Nikita, did something quite the opposite. They were shy, they were polite, they were very friendly. They even tried to think at some point. So that is a quality that makes him so incredibly charming and likable. And in the end shows that there is more than just one solution. You don't have to be a bully or you don't have to be loud to get what you want. And that is a very much needed lesson for some people. And I and I make it quick. I want to...
You don't have a list, so I'm okay.
I don't have a list. But, this is a film about a stolen movie, about a guy who went to wet carpets, to press conferences with an idea, with work that wasn't his. And for us, this prize is the biggest plot twist, because a movie about a stolen award is getting an award. It's
beautiful,
such a big
words.
Honor for us. I want to thank the RIAS committee for giving this to us. It's a big honor.
Big round of applause. And now you'll get the picture to it. Thank you guys so much. You stay with me. You just stay here. I'm like, stop. Because now we would like to take the big group picture. So please, all award winners, come up here back on stage. And now, now is your moment. Just please come all up. Let's make this an everlasting memory. Oh, that's good. All right. Here we go. A few more. We might have to squeeze a little bit, but I'm sure Jana's going to say that. Okay.
Okay.
All right. All squeezing a little bit back together.
We have to cuddle a little bit. Oh.
All right, on the count of three. One, two, three. Perfect. Thank you so much. Big round of applause for our winners, everyone. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Now we would like to commemorate an institution which had an unmatched relevance in a divided Germany. Of course, it's RIAS, the radio in the American sector, when it went on air 80 years ago as a free voice of a free world and brought independent journalism and much more for listeners and in Berlin and beyond.
We already mentioned him tonight, but I'd like to do it again. One of the legendary radio hosts at RIAS was Rick DeLisle, who sadly passed away a few weeks ago. He and many others gave RIAS a unique voice in a divided Europe.
Let us take a look at how it began in 1946 and what some of the people who made RIAS so special have to say about it.
A movie produced by our very own Christoph Jumpelt.
Wehmut. Mit diesen Gefühlen stehen wir an der Jahreswende, weil in wenigen Minuten ein halbes Jahrhundert Rundfunkgeschichte zu Ende geht. Du, lieber RIAS, hast deinen Rang in der Zeitgeschichte. Den kann dir niemand nehmen. Du hast deinen Platz im Herzen der Menschen. Da kann dich keiner verdrängen. Mach's gut, lieber Freund. Bye-bye, RIAS. Bye-bye.
The defeated Berlin. The city had been destroyed and divided into sectors by the victors. After nearly a year of economic and political chaos, the Americans announced the founding of a new radio station, Drahtfunk im amerikanischen Sektor, or DIAS. A handful of young journalists began reporting from inside Berlin.
Hier ist RIAS Berlin, eine freie Stimme der freien Welt.
Lift in 48, sponsored by the Western powers, checkmated the Russian attempt to starve out West Berlin by blockading its supply lines. RIAS's coverage became part of the unprecedented campaign. A free voice of the free world, energetically making itself heard. RIAS became the most important source of information for the eastern sector of the city and the surrounding area. Without RIAS, they would have been completely at the mercy of the propaganda from the SED, the East German Socialist Unity Party.
RIAS Berlin really was the voice of freedom. And I was brought up in East Germany. I lived there until 1955. And during all the time after the war, we were listening to RIAS Berlin. It was a voice from another world, from the West.
It was 1953. Stalin was dead and East Berlin construction workers were demonstrating against wage cuts and for free elections. The situation escalated into a popular uprising against the East German regime.
Es sind ja sehr viele Menschen geflüchtet aus der DDR und haben mit jungen DDR-Flüchtlingen, das waren ja oft junge Leute, Gespräche geführt und die kannten uns alle. Die kannten alle Mitarbeiter auch des RIAS. Wir haben ja gemerkt, welchen Einfluss wir hatten auf die Gespräche, auf das Familienleben, wenn man so will.
Over 3 million people fled East Germany, causing SED Party Chief Walter Ulbricht to tell the biggest and shortest lie of the German post-war era.
Niemand hat die Absicht, eine Mauer zu errichten.
As the world waited with bated breath on August 13th, 1961, RIAS changed its programming overnight. Its exclusive subject was the construction of the wall, 24 hours a day.
Sie blicken hier rüber, ja, sie lächeln sogar dabei, wie sie den Presslufbohrer in die Erde bohren. Und einer schaute mich an und es war in seinem Gesicht zu lesen, ja, höre nur das Geräusch, ich mache es extra für dich, damit du es auch auf deinen Tonband...
Little by little, the tragedy for the people of the city became apparent. The sudden division of the city affected all areas of life. Only the airwaves themselves couldn't be divided, despite all attempts at frequency jamming. For millions of East German citizens, RIAS now really became the credible counterbalance to SED propaganda and the bridge to the West.
Der RIAS hat den Bürgern in der DDR auch insoweit eine Stimme gegeben, als er Briefe und Informationen, die er aus der DDR, aus Ost-Berlin bekommen hat, auch aufgenommen hat in seine Programme. Und das war eben keine Hetze, die man sich erwartet, die man ihm zugeschrieben hat, sondern das war eine ruhige und sachliche und natürlich sehr kritische Berichterstattung.
Das SED-Regime hat in der Tat alles versucht, fast alles versucht, den RIAS zu verteufeln und seine Bürger davon abzuhalten, RIAS zu hören. Rias Hören, das ist bekannt, wurde unter Strafe gestellt. Und dennoch wurde der Rias zum beliebtesten Radiosender in der DDR.
Vorsicht beim Rias Hören. Vergessen Sie nicht, vor Abschalten des Apparates auf Leipzig oder Radio Berlin zurückzustellen.
Hier sind Rias Berlin vom Besuch des amerikanischen Präsidenten John F. Kennedy im freien Teil der deutschen Hauptstadt.
The American President's visit in 1963 marked a technical first for Rias. For 7 hours, its reporters gave live coverage of Kennedy's visits, which were intended as a demonstration of American support for West Berlin. Hundreds of thousands assembled in front of the Schöneberg City Hall. They experienced the young president's message firsthand, while their fellow citizens on the other side of the wall received it over the Rias airwaves.
And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Uhr ist es inzwischen geworden, meine Damen und Herren. 6:10 im RIAS Frühprogramm. Was gibt's Neues, Aktuelles?
The coming years were a time of programming innovation. Not only did the audience in the East want to be informed and entertained, but there was also demand in West Berlin.
Wir wollen Ihnen heute Abend eine neue Unterhaltungssendung vorstellen, bei der alles schiefgehen kann, bei der aber auch alles gut gehen könnte. Wir sind vorsichtig. Allein gegen alle, ein Hörer spielt gegen eine ganze Stadt.
Rock music could also carry a message, but it had to be packaged differently than on commercial radio. The example of American radio stations, which had been producing specialized programming aimed at young people for some time.
Rias pioneered a lot of radio breakthroughs for German radio that were actually copied later on.
Rias II developed a broadcasting style that was soon either copied or adopted all over West Germany and even in East Germany. With its two channels, Rias garnered the largest listening audience in both.
Wehmut. Mit diesen Gefühlen stehen wir an der Jahreswende, weil in wenigen Minuten ein halbes Jahrhundert Rundfunkgeschichte zu Ende geht. Du, lieber Rias, hast deinen Rang in der Zeitgeschichte. Den kann dir niemand nehmen. Du hast deinen Platz im Herzen der Menschen. Da kann dich keiner verdrängen. Mach's gut, lieber Freund. Bye-bye, Rias. Bye-bye.
Radio station. The reporting from inside Berlin.
Hier ist Rias Berlin. Eine freie Stimme der freien Welt.
Darüber, ja, sie lächeln sogar dabei, wie sie den Pressluftbohrer in die Erde bohren. Und einer schaute mich an und es war in seinem Gesicht zu lesen, ja, höre nur das Geräusch, ich mache es extra für dich, damit du es auch auf deinen Ton...
Little by little, the tragedy for the people of the city became apparent. The sudden division of the city affected all areas of life. Only the airwaves themselves couldn't be divided, despite all attempts at frequency jamming. For millions of East German citizens, Rias now really became the credible counterbalance to SED propaganda and the bridge to the West.
Der Rias hat den Bürgern in der DDR auch insoweit eine Stimme gegeben, als er Briefe und Informationen, die er aus der DDR, aus Ost-Berlin bekommen hat, auch aufgenommen hat in seine Programme. Und das war eben keine Hetze, die man sich erwartet, die man ihm zugeschrieben hat, sondern das war eine ruhige und sachliche und natürlich sehr kritische Berichterstattung.
Das SED-Regime hat in der Tat alles versucht, fast alles versucht, den Rias zu verteufeln und seine Bürger davon abzuhalten, Rias zu hören. Rias hören, das ist bekannt, wurde unter Strafe gestellt. Und dennoch wurde der Rias zum beliebtesten Radiosender in der DDR.
Vorsicht beim Rias hören. Vergessen Sie nicht, vor Abschalten des Apparates auf Leipzig oder Radio Berlin zurückzustellen.
Hier sind Rias Berlin vom Besuch des amerikanischen Präsidenten John F. Kennedy im freien Teil der deutschen Hauptstadt.
The American President's visit in 1963 marked a technical first for Rias. For 7 hours, its reporters gave live coverage of Kennedy's visits, which were intended as a demonstration of American support for West Berlin. Hundreds of thousands assembled in front of the Schöneberg City Hall. They experienced the young president's message firsthand, while their fellow citizens on the other side of the wall received it over the Rias airwaves.
And therefore, as a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Uhr 10 ist es inzwischen geworden, meine Damen und Herren. 6:10 im RIAS Frühprogramm. Was gibt's Neues, Aktuelles?
The coming years were a time of programming innovation. Not only did the audience in the East want to be informed and entertained, but there was also demand in West Berlin.
Wir wollen Ihnen heute Abend eine neue Unterhaltungssendung vorstellen, bei der alles schiefgehen kann, bei der aber auch alles gut gehen könnte. Wir sind vorsichtig. Allein gegen alle, ein Hörer spielt gegen eine ganze Stadt.
Rock music could also carry a message, but it had to be packaged differently than on commercial radio. The example of American radio stations, which had been producing specialized programming aimed at young people for some time.
Rias pioneered a lot of radio breakthroughs for German radio that were actually copied later on.
Rias II developed a broadcasting style that was soon either copied or adopted all over West Germany and even in East Germany. With its two channels, Rias garnered the largest listening audience in both.
We are really, really sorry, but I'll make sure that the video will be on the website so everyone can watch it. I just heard we cannot, but thank you, Chris. I do know it took him weeks and weeks to work on that movie. It's breaking my heart, to be honest. We're really sorry. Okay.
So we move on to our next point, which is the legacy of a free voice, of a free word, has become a challenge for journalism even today. That's why it's so important to talk about international independent journalism. And we have some special guests for you tonight. So I'm really happy to welcome David Falkenfilk of the National Public Radio, NPR, Ines Pohl of Deutsche Welle, and David Anser, former director of Voice of America.
And No. And the one who's moderating the panel talk is former RIAS editor-in-chief. He's former news anchor of one of the most known, most watched news shows in Germany. He was also U.S. correspondent. He interviewed presidents like Barack Obama or George W. Bush. I grew up watching him with my entire family every night for almost 2 decades. He's one of the reasons why I wanted to become a journalist.
Don't cry.
And no, I won't. I'm trying here. And just so you all understand the dimension. So when I tell my mom, I'm like, oh, you know, I host this, I do that, I interview. It can be the chancellor. She's like, oh, cool, that's nice. So I told her, Klaus Kleber will be here tonight. And she goes, with so much excitement, our Klaus Kleber. So apparently you're still part of the family, and we are very honored to have you here tonight. Klaus Kleber and his amazing panel guests.
Hello.
Thank you.
All my best.
Thank you so much.
Damage I can do is limited. Here is one.
I'm kidding.
Da 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 da. Okay. Thank you. Now, total control. First time in my life. Yes. Thank you very much for this nice welcome. Let me start with a very personal story. I was the shortest-lived chief editor of RIAS. I was it for, I think, 21 months or something like this, but I picked the right ones. It was the year 89 and 90. So I hope it is clear now who brought the wall down. And this was a fascinating assignment, to be the chief editor of the station in these tumultuous times. And just to give you a better idea of the importance of RIAS, I share with you a little episode which was shared by me with from the staff when I first came to Berlin. And they said, you need to know that RIAS has more listeners in East Germany and East Berlin than all state media there combined. And this is a symbol for that, is one occurrence, because the state really understood, like all autocratic systems in the world, how dangerous free journalism can be. And when it comes from the outside, it's even more dangerous. And this is after the SED understood that RIAS is so successful, the Central Committee, just a couple blocks down, had this emergency session. And Honecker himself, of course, chaired this meeting, and he was very angry, and he said, we now close all these doors. Nobody is leaving this room until we have made our decisions. And Central Committee sessions were very long. 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. What shall we do with RIAS? Nobody had real ideas, but everybody had a lot to say. And after 3 or so hours, one said, Mr. Secretary, I'm Genosse Honecker. I need to leave the room just briefly. And he said, no way, nobody is leaving. No leak here. And so what shall I do? There's a vase over there, use that. And the meeting continued. And more and more used to this, used the vase. And then there was a knock on the door, and Honecker was very agitated. I ordered no interruptions. Who is this? Door opened, an elderly housekeeping lady is coming in. I said, I told you, nobody can come in. And she said, but your vase is full. I'm bringing a new one. How do you know? It was on RIAS. So, in this case, this was free. Free press was a real relief for this room. And we want to talk about the repercussions of free media and the dangers for free media with a very competent panel here. I would like to start with David Enzor. Please, David, join us up here. I take this seat, the others are free. He is representing international radio and television from American side, because he was the director of Voice of America. He is also a companion of mine in understanding the United States nationally and internationally as a correspondent for ABC News. He was also the White House correspondent, Department of State. You were the correspondent. He worked for CNN. He was a diplomat in Afghanistan. So a very interesting professional life until now. And it is continuing indeed. And I'm glad you are here, David. Thank you very much. Recently, he corralled all but one of earlier directors of Voice of America into a common appeal to the Congress to save Voice of America from the Trump wrecking ball. And we know that the public uprising against killing Voice of America led to a court decision which says it must continue now. Unfortunately, it is not really working at this moment, but the fight is going on, and we will see how this will end. And this will be part of our debate in a few minutes. Then Ines Pohl, she is, so to speak, Ines is a RIAS Award alumna. She got the award for an in-depth interview with George Bush Jr. quite a while ago. And she was chief editor both of Taz and of Deutsche Welle, editor-in-chief, and was then promoted to Washington bureau chief, the highest position you can have in any network. Let me start with a question to you. Before I know there is one more, and I look forward to this, but I would like to start our conversation with you, Ines, because you are the closest to RIAS in your job. How safe do you feel now in your profession when you work from Washington? What has changed?
A lot. So I've been covering Washington 2015, the first Trump election. And now I'm back since 6 years or so, 5.5 years. You know, I get a great support from Deutsche Welle. This is, as we heard also tonight from many of the award winners, the most important thing, that we have the support from our bases, from our colleagues back home. There are times, I'm also a White House correspondent, when President Trump is attacking you directly, when he's looking in your face and say, "Who are you? Whom are you with? Where are you from?" And then you think, you know, what happens next? And then he says, "Your reporting is fake news. We bring you down. You are the reason why people shoot at me." Or when you go to conferences and Richard Grenell, who many of you probably know, he was the former ambassador to Germany, shouts at you and says, "You are the reason, your reporting is the reason, Deutsche Welle is the reason why Donald Trump is attacked." So there are moments, and we have some colleagues here, of course, who are covering also Washington, when you really think, gosh, I didn't sign up for China or Russia, it's the United States. So, yeah, there are moments that you are afraid that you get kicked off the country if you don't have an American passport. And I think the biggest really threat is not so much that you get kicked out of the country, but that the Schere im Kopf starts working and you don't ask the questions you should work. So, you know, I think that's the bigger threat actually for us journalists than really being kicked out of the country. we won't get arrested in the United States yet.
Okay, thank you. It has changed a lot, and one who professionally follows American media and their relation to the powers that be is David Falkenflik of National Public Radio. He is the media correspondent. Please join us on stage.
So glad you are here. Oh, no, we're here.
David, you are something to a German audience. It's like combined medias res in Deutschlandfunk and ZAP in ARD, which is the two main programs in radio and television, watching our own business, the media business. You had a very busy day yesterday because Ted Turner passed away, the creator of CNN, of a nonstop news program internationally around the world. And I wanted to give you a chance to quickly honor this tremendous achievement, which really changed our professional world and the world at large. Ted Turner, what is his heritage?
Ted Turner, and also, what an extraordinary thing it is to join you all tonight. So thank you for this invitation, mm-hmm. and thank you for letting me weigh in. You know, Ted Turner was an iconoclast. He was very much somebody who was competitive and driven and ambitious and wanted to make money, but also thought about the consequences of what he did. And you could see it in how he approached television, how he innovated and pushed the boundaries. He saw, he listened to actually to radio and to the all news channels in the States. And he said, why isn't that possible for television? Why are we taking at that time 22, 24 minutes a night, now more like 18 or 19, in an evening newscast on the three major commercial broadcast networks? Why couldn't we do that instead of 24 minutes, 24 hours? Mm-hmm. And why can't we be present? And why can't we tell the news straight? So he was a person of very deeply held beliefs and convictions. He dedicated his fortune and his time to philanthropic ventures. He gave $1 billion to the United Nations to help prop it up in the late 1990s financially, but also inspired other major billionaires, people like Warren Buffett, people like Bill Gates, to devote an enormous amount of their own fortunes towards major philanthropic efforts. But in the news, he wanted people, and I think this is so important, to have the information that they needed to be able to make decisions for themselves. While he had strong points of view, he wanted you as consumers internationally, Americans at home at first, to be able to understand the world. And he thought that by understanding one another, we were less likely to be engaged in conflict with one another as well.
And he created a network which is not only reporting about the world, but it's also seen around the globe. Now, with something like this coming out of America, a private business enterprise, and being extremely successful, why would it still take Voice of America to get the American viewpoints known around the world?
Well, because CNN is only in English and Spanish, and Voice of America, last I checked, was until 2025, was in 49 languages. When I was director, there were 63. And the fact is, you can reach a lot more people if you speak their language. We got to the point, we started off in Africa, just in French. But as we brought more and more of the languages of the different countries in Africa to the people there, the audience mushroomed enormously. And VOA's audience was 361 million per week on radio, television, or the web on the day it closed.
And Trump didn't seem to be interested in informing the world about America. What is it he doesn't get?
Donald Trump only understands hard power. He has no concept of what soft power is or why you might even want to have some. And so, you know, you look at the effort I mean, I wanted to make a note, so forgive me, but the goal of the Trump administration is to intimidate rather than to persuade, and to compel rather than to attract. But Voice of America is all about attraction. It's about the value of truth-telling and the idea that in a democracy, we value that above all. I know that, I remember when I was director in 2014, when the Black Power movement started after a murder in Ferguson, Missouri. And the audiences around the world, especially in countries like Iran, Russia, China, suddenly mushroomed as Voice of America sent almost all of its correspondents to cover this story. Why did everyone find it so compelling? Because here was a country which has lots of problems being truthful about its own problems. By doing that, we built over the years credibility at Voice of America. The first broadcast at Voice of America, which was in German, by the way, the words were, "This is the Voice of America. The news may be good, the news may be bad. We will tell you the truth." And the truth was that the Allies were losing battles, that the Nazis were winning battles. And that is what Voice of America reported until the first time that the tide turned and the victory started to come. That's what's so precious to people, is telling the truth. Donald Trump does not understand that.
We have... My generation still remembers from the tales of their parents how important the BBC World Reporting in German language was during the Second World War to get a concept of what is really happening on the battlefields and internationally, because, of course, the Nazi propaganda never told them anything about it. And that means this was a very powerful tool, even as an instrument of war, as long as you tell the truth and the people believe you that you tell the truth. So now in peaceful times, Ines, part of your job is to... So the green one is now with Ines. Telling the truth about Germany to Americans, right? Do you have any concept how you are listened to in America and what your influence is?
Yeah, so for us as Deutsche Welle, the United States is a priority market. It has been for a long time, but it is especially now, because you all follow, some of you are Americans, and you all, of course, follow what is going on in this country very closely. And it's so funny when you say Trump doesn't believe in truth. His social media account is called Truth Social, right? And if you don't report in a way he wants you to report, then it's hate speech. But what he does is just like freedom of speech. I just had to say that because it just came to my mind.
And Fox News is fair and balanced, as they say every
right.
day.
Yeah. So, but you know, it's interesting in the United States. We as foreign media have a chance to talk to people who wouldn't talk to CNN, NPR, or Voice of America if they would be asked, because they would think, no, they're far too biased. The other side of the aisle wouldn't talk to Fox News because they are too biased. And this is a place where international media like Deutsche Welle or the BBC or France 24 can go in. You know, we get access to Republicans who wouldn't talk to you, David. Because they think, oh, NPR, you know, and
is that a problem, David?
That is something which is actually really valued by many Americans, because they see us as a more neutral power, more interested in also like a more global perspective on news. We don't go into the nitty gritty. We rather try to explain also what is going on, what it means for the rest of the world. So we have a fairly big reach in the United States through our partnerships with PBS, but also through our YouTube channels and through our social media channels.
I have the same impression from my reporting before the last election, that a lot of American people, especially I went without team, without anybody, just for myself. I passed some time in Georgia, one of the important states. And so many people said, ah, you are from Germany, right? And then they talked. We wouldn't talk to American media anymore. And they mean all of them, not just ABC, CBS, NBC, etc. Also, Fox, we don't want to have anything to do with them. And you can always be the clueless German who needs some education. Don't you have an election coming up? This is how the conversation started. And you felt how the democratic exchange, which is important in every society, especially in election times, which will create a new common denominator, hopefully, is not happening anymore. Does that include NPR, the always so, you know, noble and high moral standards NPR with its immense reputation?
So NPR is in a funny position because and let me just say for the outset, I have to cover when NPR is in the news, which it has been of late, and therefore I don't speak for the institution, but they write my checks, and I'm appreciative of it. NPR is in the funny place of becoming, in my belief, from covering the media for the past 26 years, one of the indispensable news organizations of America, a place that does not focus its attention solely upon Washington or New York or the great capitals, but throughout the land, with people based there, people of there, people who speak in those accents, who understand. And at the same time, there's been both a decades-long campaign, primarily but not solely from the right, to discredit the press broadly, and that in the past 15 months of the second term of the Trump administration, there's been an intensification of that attack, really sort of an all-out assault, a multi-front assault on the press. And NPR is at the center of one of those fights. And it was over whether or not there would still be federal financing for public media. And we were the greatest target rhetorically within that.
Rhetorically, also financially.
Financially, yes. But I just
$500 million are quite an amount to take away from somewhere.
Yes, very little from us, but we don't own the hundreds of stations across the country that broadcast our shows, and all of that money was wiped out as a result of this debate. That's a very serious consequence. The president's party had for years run in part on calling for our money to be taken away, and yet they were, I think, many of them happy to lose it. Many of them valued the civil discourse, the time they were afforded to speak about their stances on issues in front of listeners who are also voters, and also happy to have the issue year after year. This time they won the issue, and it was all taken away. And that's actually had real consequence, much less for us, but for our stations, many of whom serve very loyal audiences in very red states that are supportive of the president. So it's a nuanced consequence there. It's really hurting a lot of rural stations very deeply in places where people have often voted to support the president. All of that said, there has been an intensification of the question that you raise. Are there people in government who won't speak to NPR? There has been a greater dynamic in that direction. One example I'll say is I did our coverage of this very debate in front of Congress, where various senators were, you know, taking swings at us and saying that public media should lose its funding. I asked 14 or 15 members of Congress to come on the show so that they could present their argument as to why it wasn't merited, not a debate, but for coverage, to allow them to have 5 to 7 minutes to ventilate their opinion in front of millions of listeners. All of them declined. Now, that to me was a sign that they didn't want to engage in the debate or that they didn't want to legitimize us as a source. That said, throughout the country, our listeners, Democrats, Republicans, independents, are strong. We are popular in many red states. I think that we are among 5-7 key news organizations that serve the country broadly in a way that, you know, it's my hope and belief will continue without that funding.
Beyond NPR, David, it was American journalism was to us here in Germany especially for the young ones, always the role model. We wanted everybody who anchors in a German news program is following either Peter Jennings or Dan Rather or whatever the type it is. You have this ideal. I can talk about myself in this phase. And also the way American press is handling the issues is a role model. Polite, strict, just the facts, you know, but in a certain elegant British-American way. So my question to you, as our idols, more or less, what is the state of our profession in your model country today? Are we witnessing the winter, the upcoming winter of professional journalism and radio and television, or is there a way out? Why don't you start?
Let's be frank. Journalism in the United States is in trouble right now. It's under siege, as has been discussed. And, you know, I'm old enough to have worked directly with Peter Jennings and many of the people that we all looked up to in those days, and I tried to emulate their style of reporting. But I remember after I moved to CNN, there was a point at which I started to be asked on the air live for my opinions about things.
Mm-hmm.
And you just don't do that the way my old school journalism rules are. So I would be asked for my opinion, and I would not give it. I would say, I would obfuscate. I would say, well, you know, it's very complicated, and say something else, you know, just not answer. Because my opinion, I always felt, is not the point. People want you to give the facts and let them draw their own views. I remember being at CNN once, and Tucker Carlson, who also was there at the same time, came by to see me, and he said, "You're a wonderful national security correspondent. I think you're a Republican."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "I'm not."
It's none of your business.
"Well, it doesn't matter because I feel good about your reporting."
Mm-hmm.
"Good, thank you very much, Tucker." But the same thing, nobody could tell what party I belonged to, and I didn't. I was an independent. So that, and that whole concept of journalism is changed now because cable, because of the internet, it's possible to have so many different opinions and different views. The audience is segmented into parts, and we've become a very divided nation. I'm sure this is true in a lot of other places. I know, for example, Poland very well. It's an incredibly divided nation at this point. The same is true in so many other places around the world. And it's a challenge facing all of journalism, all the media, certainly.
Especially in Germany. Yeah.
This segmenting of the population into often angry separate parts.
I wonder whether you join my impression over the many years that in American media, Ines, the separation of reporting and opinion made opinionating is sharper than in our German radio television culture. Would you agree with that?
It used to be like that. I mean, it always surprises German journalists when they visit American newsrooms that literally the opinion, or it used to be like that. The people in the opinion section sometimes were in different buildings, right? In the old post, they were in a different building, so they couldn't, or floors. And here in Germany, the tradition is that might surprise you Americans. People sometimes write a report, and then they write the opinion piece regarding the facts they kind of contributed in their report. I'm so glad that the Peter Thiel podcast got an award. That's fantastic. And I know that we were in talks with Deutsche Welle, if you could translate it into English, because I think this podcast needs to be listened to in the United States. Applause.
Mm-hmm.
But that, I'm answering your question, you know. I think the most dangerous thing really is when it comes to opinion is really like the algorithms and the social media platform who are owned by people like Peter Thiel. And they are much more in control on what people are receiving on their social media feeds than any, you know, the division between opinion pages and the rest of the paper. So I think this is the new threat when it comes to intermingling reporting and opinion pieces, it's going beyond that. You know, that would be a format discussion. But it's going beyond that because it's not really the consumers anymore who are deciding, do I want to go to opinion page or do I want to listen to a report? Mm-hmm. They just get something which is so in this toxic, totally polarized country, which everything basically is opinion, because facts as such are not seen as such, right? So, yeah, that would be my longer answer to your short question.
The other thing is that my experience at RIAS, which is after all an American institution in Germany, was very surprising. I mentioned it was 89 and 90, a very important time. I was a chief editor, and Harry Gilmore, who was the mission chief of the Americans here in Berlin, had influence, of course, on his creation, RIAS. And in the midst of the debate about reunification, yes or no, and how to... I met him at some point, and I said, Harry, I'm the chief editor. How come you represent the United States here? How come you never came to me or called me in to discuss the substance of our reporting and opinionating? I haven't heard a word from you. And that's important times, isn't it? And he said, well, this is my job, is not to watch that you follow the American political line. My job is that you do journalism the American way, and that means government stays out of the way. That was a key event in my American education. Of course, Donald Trump wouldn't hesitate a second to take influence, right?
Well, I mean, think of what you're talking about, because I think this is a key thing. It is implicit in what we're saying, but it's not always made explicit. What RIAS is doing, what Voice of America is doing, what DW is doing, it's both providing news, often at a time or in countries where a free press is not viable or a free press is not allowed or permitted. It's also modeling what a pluralistic democratic society can be like. It's letting you know, hey, sometimes we report when things aren't going well for the country that we represent. That's going to be part of our reporting. Hey, sometimes the government's going to look bad. That's part of our reporting. Sometimes we'll have dissenting voices on. In fact, we'll have them on frequently. Voices that are out of government, people in the streets. That's part of our reporting. We are modeling what a democratic society looks like. This is the soft power that David Ansor is talking about, because it says not only are we providing you information, folks, this is a pretty appealing look at what a society can look like. It isn't just what's dictated to you. It's what you feel in your heart. And so I think this is the power of what RIAS did, what Voice America does in many ways, what NPR does from a different standpoint. We are a private, we received money, that's past tense now, but we received money from the federal government. But as a private corporation incorporated in Washington, D.C., this is part of our model, mission and model as well, is that you can do both at once, it seems to me, without being told what to do, right? Mm-hmm. In the case of Voice of America by somebody else. It doesn't mean that there couldn't be carefully labeled editorials. That's part of the price of admission. You are a government entity. But there is an acknowledgement of the distinction. I think in the U.S. there is this tension to what you're describing about opinion and about voice. We all want voice. We want brilliant podcasts to be done. That relies on voice. Sometimes that takes on a narrative direction, even if it's not an ideological point of view. That's a very fine distinction for a lot of people. But I think it's one worth making. A lot of newspapers are moving away from having editorials in the United States. A lot of newspapers are moving away from endorsements. That can be controversial, as it was in the case of the Washington Post, which did so about 10 days before the elections in 2024. But as a general proposition, newspapers are saying maybe we don't tell people what to think as much, even in our editorial side, even as, thanks to the web, thanks to cable news, which is even on CNN, increasingly dominated by points of view, and thanks to social media, where the algorithms are telling you what they think you want to hear and see, opinion is prevalent.
And still, David, let me confront you with an observation. I think we have to do some self-reflecting, because there must be reasons why large parts of the audience don't follow us anymore. They don't believe us anymore. And as always, America is quite a few steps ahead in these developments. And I say that with great concern. And I had the luck to report really from all 50 states over all these years I spent in America. And the flyover states, of course, were the biggest part of that. And I remember meeting people who were just not up to date, in a way. People who deeply believed in God and country, in community, in family, in patriotism, all these things. And I got the impression that the media overall, not just news reporting, even the television dramas, the Hollywood films, it didn't reflect their world anymore. They never saw a film about a family with mother and father, two genders for them, and children, the wife staying home being the more traditional way, believing in their country and in God. That didn't happen. It seemed to have, you know, it was past times. And they were, of course, good targets for somebody to come and say, I think I see the world like you see the world, and we are not the deplorables. If you vote right, in both senses of the word, if you vote right, we will win. This is something George W. Bush...
this is the whole promise of the Fox network and the Fox
Absolutely.
News. It was to say, we're fair and balanced, as David mentioned, we're fair and balanced. And the implication was, and the rest of the folks are not.
Exactly. But many people believe it because culturally they felt left behind. Did we miss something there which we should have addressed earlier?
Look, I think it's part of the world we live in, right? Mm-hmm. Is that... there are massive changes in demographics and in what questions of orientation and ways which Americans do that, all kinds of other changes. Some of that is not fast enough for Americans. Some of that is way too fast. And I think the press does generally gets itself in trouble if it decides exactly where the right point that history should land upon should be. And I think at times people feel, hey, you're telling us what the end of the result of this argument is, but the argument's still playing out in American society, and we need to figure that out together. I think that at times the press was very taken with itself. There was a lot of money to be made in broadcast television, and so you saw networks that were sort of thought about themselves at their top levels as stars and celebrities, as opposed to thinking I'm here on behalf of people who aren't either placed or informed to be able to report on these issues themselves. You know, we tend to think of ourselves as in the place of Americans who are busy, who have jobs, who have families, who have other obligations. And so they could do the reporting themselves, but they grace us with their time because they live busy lives and they want to be informed about it.
At times
the press has not listened as much as it has talked. Mm-hmm. Right. One of the values of radio to me is that you can hear people in their own voices at their own pace with the emotional power and valence of their own words and the way in which they express themselves. And one of the things I value about public radio, and I'm sure it's true here as well, is that they let stories unfold. They give it time and it conveys a respect. And I think television news and oftentimes reporters on tough deadlines for big publications, which it's called parachute in the States, and they would get quick sound bites and they would parachute out. Mm-hmm. And part of our mission through our local stations and the 17 people we have at different states around the country is to not do that, is to understand those areas, is to work together collaboratively, do that. But it is a challenge and it is
it is an obligation, because I think too often people don't feel reflected in how their communities or their belief systems or their families are represented in major outlets.
David, can I just, do you see what, a chance just for...
Quick anecdote, yeah, if I may, I'm leading on from this. In the sort of 1982, 3, somewhere in there, I'm sitting in the White House booth of ABC News next to Sam Donaldson, and he opens a paper and he says, "Oh no, oh God, this is terrible." I said, "What? What?" "ABC News turned a profit."
Uh-huh.
"This is the worst news I've ever heard," said Sam. I said, "Why? What's so bad?" And he said, "Now that we've made a profit, we're going to have to keep making a profit. The bean counters will come, and the whole thing is going to change. We're not public service anymore. Now we're for profit, and it's all about money from now on." Sam was right.
Yeah, but then again, American television, and that was the astounding thing for me as a German, is they did make money with news, and they did good news programs, role models for us. And I interviewed, I come up with this later. The thing is, it was possible in America to do television business with high journalistic standards. And my question to you is there a way back to that in your observation, or have we lost that for good?
I still, as director of the OA, what I said to people was, we may try any number of different platforms, every different kind of presentation. I'm open to everything, whatever your market seems to want. But there are certain old-fashioned journalistic values that I will insist you maintain. And I still think that's where we have to be. There has to be a code of ethics for our craft. There is a code of ethics. And in fact, it's laid out in the law covering the VOA charter. And if we stick to that, I think ultimately the audience will return to us, and does return when they get that kind of journalism.
Let's be fair. There's terrible journalism. There's stuff that doesn't even qualify as journalism. Right. And there are attacks to journalism's credibility and its financial model. There are also brilliant, intrepid, fearless, innovative, wonderful journalists. Some of them doing this for decades. Some of them emerge from nowhere, you know, on Substack or some other place, who are greatly adding to our understanding of the world around us and our immediate communities. So I see things at times I'm blown away by younger colleagues. So I don't despair. I don't think it's all one direction. I tend to think life kind of goes on a pendulum. And I am hopeful for a lot of the energy I see from people who don't know what they've lost. They don't know that things may have been in a better place for television, because they don't separate out television from digital, from podcast. It's all part of the same, hey, there's a lot of stories to tell and let's tell them, right?
Indeed. And I must say, and I get signals from the back where the boss stands, that we had to round this up. And this is the perfect moment to do it, because a celebration like this tonight really gives me incredible courage and optimism when I see the young people who are now laureates of RIAS Berlin, and in other contests as well. When I see the younger generation in my own editorial staff, and I realize I'm working with the best of the young people who are far better, I wouldn't have competed with them 30, 40 years ago when I started. So there is definitely a future in all of your work, and it's worth to work for. And I'm leaving this evening, and I hope you do it with me with great optimism. Our art and our craft is still in demand and is still being offered by brilliant young people. Thank you very much for listening.
Klaus,
let's give David a chance.
I want one word. I promise you, Voice of America will be back. I promise you.
fight, fight.
So,
thank you so much.
Thank you, Klaus Deva, David Folgenfeng, Ines Pohl, and David Enser for sharing your perspectives tonight. I think you really showed how important it is to have a look on transatlantic journalism even today.
And of course, Jan wants one more picture. Oh, we may join. All right. We can also swap afterwards.
I'll take my picture.
Big smile. It can't be bigger than mine.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, and thank you so much. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Well, thanks for the entire team who made this evening possible. Thank you to amazing Pam and wonderful Christina. And Chris, I know you do not like to be in the spotlight, but that's exactly where you belong. Woo! Big round of applause for Chris. Thanks for everything you do for Riaz.
Soweit die Teilwiedergabe der Preisverleihung der Riaz Media Awards 2026 im Berliner Roten Rathaus am 7. Mai 2026 ab 18 Uhr. Für diejenigen, die die Medienhöllenausgaben der roten Serie 5, 15 und 20 noch nicht gesehen oder gehört haben, sei dies ausdrücklich empfohlen.
Medienhölle.
Dokument.
Und jetzt abonnieren, kommentieren. Denken Sie daran.
Vergessen Sie nicht, Ihre Antennen zu erden.
Don't forget to ground.